We're going to go ahead, a quorum being present, and call the August 25th meeting of Stan Sarah to order. And I'd like to ask for a roll call.
Gordon Ford.
Here.
Maria DeAnda. Donna Riley. Jason Gordo. Mike Lynch.
Here.
Jim DeMartini.
Here.
Sam Sharp.
Here.
Michael O'Neill. Joan Clendenin. Jeff Grover.
Present.
We have a quorum, and just to note, Jeff Grover will be chairing our meeting today in the absence of our vice chair and our chair.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any announcements that anyone would like to make?
Yes.
I have several. Okay.
Yours is for later on, right?
No, I'm just saying.
Go ahead, you can do yours first.
I just wanted to give an update on some building stuff we've been working on. Tomorrow we start replacing the stained carpets in the hallway. It should take a few days to get that done. We're actually going to use like a vinyl. It's vinyl, but it looks like wood. So, county, as far as the HVAC stuff, county maintenance came and mapped out the ductwork for us. And we had an air balancing firm come and look at everything and the plans. And it's going to take more than just air balancing to get it fixed. So we're still working on that. And then as far as the build out goes and the vacant space, even though it's not a county project, we have to follow all the city rules. So there's a gentleman in purchasing who has agreed to work with me, and we're going to start putting an RFP together to get some prices. So that's kind of what's going on with that.
All right. I have several announcements to make. MID, we got a quote to bury the underground lines, and that's a firm quote for 90 days, and that's $150,000. They've also included in their analysis another option where it would cost us $2,700 per occurrence to shut down the power and have them wash the windows. If you look at the difference between the two proposals on a present value basis and you assume that one would wash the windows once a year, it doesn't make sense to spend $150,000 up front. However, I think for aesthetics, for one thing, and I think the fact that we still may not be able to find a window washer that would come in even with the lines up there, because they would have to essentially create some sort of repelling issue to go down and clean the windows, that it still may be more feasible just to bury the wires once and for all and get it done with. Having said that, Donna Riley is going to contact a window washer or two and find out if there truly is an issue, if we don't bury the lines, if they can still do it. We need to find this stuff out regardless of what we think here in this room, because there are five, six other tenants within this building, and we have to present this cost proposal and our recommendation to that group at some point in time.
So are we 1/6 the 150, or that's the 1/6 the total?
We're approximately 1/6 of the total.
Of the 150?
Yeah. Okay, exactly. So from our perspective, it doesn't sound like a whole lot of money, but we do need to consider everybody else in the equation here. So we're going to get a 12th Street committee meeting together pretty soon once Donna finds out if window washers would still be able to do the job with the wires there and the power turned off. So once we get that nailed down before we make any final decision, we will come to you for final approval.
So somewhere around $25,000 is part of that deal?
At this point.
Yeah. Okay.
It'll probably be a little more because of the AT&T cost to bury the cable, but since MID is already going to be doing the work, it would be a lot cheaper to have them do it at that time.
Okay.
Trustee DeMartini asked about position upgrades last time. A little bit of information. I dropped the ball on that. I have to admit that there's a process that I didn't go through and haven't completed the information that the county wants. I'm about halfway through that, and I'll probably get that to them this week, and then the ball will be in their court from that point forward. But I can keep you up to speed on that as we go through that process. We had to make a minor change in the asset liability study for this year. We had originally intended for that to be on the 10th of November. We are having to move that to December 16th, and basically that's because of the transition between SIS and Verus, the new investment consultant. They felt that it was a little bit of a short timeline for them to be prepared for this. So we will push the asset liability study to December 16th, and we'll have that in conjunction with the regular investment admin meeting. We're going to be doing that at where?
Seasons.
Seasons. On the McHenry, it'll probably start around 9 o'clock in the morning, and it'll probably be most of the day on the 16th.
There's only one board meeting in December.
Right. Actually, if you think about it, starting in November this year, we will be going to one board meeting a month.
So what day is this whole day?
December 16th.
December 16th.
It's a Wednesday. It is actually the board meeting day.
Okay, a couple other things, just to briefly discuss the transition from SIS to Verus. Verus's first appearance here before this board will be our next investment meeting, which is 9/22. They won't be ready to present our data with their own reports, so we've agreed to use Northern Trust's reports in transition for 1 month, and then in the October investment meeting, we'll be on full board with Verus, and we'll be using all their investment reports and materials as well. And then just to keep you up to speed, Ed Hoffman from Verus over the next month or two will be contacting each of you individually, and we'll be trying to set up a personal face-to-face meeting with each board trustee. They kind of want to get an idea of this board's individual and in the aggregate risk profile, trying to understand personal biases. We all have personal biases in terms of the way we think about investments and stuff. And they want to kind of get an idea of how this board feels, like I said, individually and in the aggregate as well. So they will be contacting you probably over the next month to 2 months to set up a meeting with you. And they want to do it in person instead of telephonically.
This is part of their standard transition model.
Right. Yeah, this is nothing new. And then the last thing I want to say is I want you all to realize that this is Nate Pratt's last day with Stan Sara. Nate's been on the job and on the ball for 5 years. As soon as he started with SIS, he took on Stan Sara as a client, and I grew very fond of Nate. Him and I speak the same language, I think, in a lot of ways. We speak the same way. And I'm truly, truly going to miss Nate. I think he's a valuable addition, not only to SIS, but to Stan Sara and to every client that he serves. I think he gives 100%. He doesn't hold anything back, and I think he's very honest in his assessment of what it is we do and how we implement investment decisions and the investment governance process. And I'm truly going to miss you, and I'm sure the entire board will as well. Thanks.
Okay, thank you for that. Opportunity for public comment from anybody from the public that would care to comment on something that's not on the agenda. Seeing none, we'll move on to item 5, which are consent items, primarily just the meeting minutes from August 12th. I'm going to take a motion for approval unless someone would like to pull that.
Approval.
Have a motion. Is there a second? Okay, we have a motion and a second for approval of the consent items. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. We have approved minutes. And we'll move then into item 6, which is annual performance review for LSV Asset Management. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
We're going to look at probably 15 to 20 minutes of presentation, total of a half an hour worth of questions.
Okay.
Go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff. And good to see everyone. Thanks for having us this afternoon, having us in. Just reintroducing, my name is Keith Brook, and I'm Director of Client Service at LSV, and been working with Stan Sara since the inception of this account, which is now coming up on 11 years. And with me, you've met before, Swami. Bhaskaran Swaminathan is our Director of Research, and given that what's going on in the markets, I think it's a good time to have Swami join and at least give a couple of thoughts there. I'll give you a brief update on the organization, and we can talk about performance over the last year, and then maybe spend a little more time on just the topical discussion of what's going on in the markets, answer any questions that you have, how the portfolio is positioned, and where we think their opportunities lie for an international manager. As you recall, we're managing an international portfolio for you, and we have since 2004. And we're invested in both the developed and the emerging markets. We don't make calls on countries. We don't say that we think that the emerging markets are going to do better than the developed markets, or that Germany is going to do better than Japan or China. We stay pretty neutral across the world relative to our benchmark, but we're picking stocks from the bottom up. We're a deep value manager. We like cheap stocks that that we find attractive from a valuation standpoint. So let me start with just a quick update on the organization. On the first couple of pages, page one, there's really been no changes to the firm. We're structured as a general partnership, so there's 25 of us that share an ownership in the firm. So it's broadly diversified, but Joseph Lekanishak is the founding partner and the majority shareholder in the firm. But that hasn't changed, and we don't expect to see any change there the way that we're structured. We celebrated our 20th anniversary last year, so we've been in the business for 20 years, and appreciate your business more than half of that time. You've been a client of ours. You know, right now, at least, well, I shouldn't say now, I think at the end of June, we had $90.7 billion in assets under management. It's probably down a little bit, given the last what's gone on in the markets in the last week or so, and about $20 billion in the strategy that you're invested in. Our client base is very similar to yours, all institutional, large pension funds, endowments, foundations, but very, very similar to your approach type of client. We've seen positive cash flows into the strategy in the last year since we got together. So it's been just kind of growing at the margin. Page two is the investment team and the operations and compliance group. There's been no changes to this group since we last met. I mentioned Joseph. As the founding partner, still involved in all aspects of the investment process. Swami heads up our research effort, and Puneet Anshurmani, another key portfolio manager, Menno Vermeulen on the systems development team. So the same senior group that has been working together since over the last 10 years, and we don't expect to see any changes there. No retirements on the horizon. We may add one more quantitative analyst, a junior level position. But other than that, this should look very similar when we get together next. Questions on the organization? Okay. Page three, just real briefly, just a quick summary. You know, on the right hand side of the page, as I mentioned, we got started in 2004, so September 14th, and basically you've kind of stood pat. There's been some contributions, withdrawals over time, but net not a lot. Being invested in the international strategy, and we've added a little bit of value over this time period, has tacked on about 100 million in assets, and right now at 6:30, the account stood at about 177 million. Why don't we turn over to we can skip to page maybe page eight. And talk about performance, and then I'll turn it over to Swami. We'll talk a little bit about kind of the markets and answer any questions that you have. But a lot of numbers on this page. At the top, we have the annualized performance, both gross and net of fees, and we'll focus on the net of fee line numbers, so the second line in, and then the two benchmarks, the MSCI All Country World ex-U.S., so it's about 25% emerging markets, about 75% developed markets outside the U.S., and then the value benchmark. As I mentioned up front, we're a deep value manager. We're going to, we think we can outperform both of those benchmarks over time, but we would correlate a little bit more, or be a little more similar to the characteristics of the value benchmark, if you will. Year to date, your portfolio through 6/30 was up 5.4, but that's somewhat irrelevant now. So I can fast forward to the end of day yesterday, and your portfolio is down 6.5%. So the benchmark is down 7.3, and the value benchmark down even a little bit more, 9.3%. So a big reversal just this quarter. So just this quarter. Emerging markets, so 25% of your portfolio, just not our emerging markets piece, but just emerging markets in general, are down 20%. So a full, what is defined as a correction in emerging markets, particularly Russia, China, obviously, less so, I mean, Brazil, Argentina, a lot of these countries have been down 20% just in the last 8 weeks. The developed market's not quite as much, down about 7-8%. But anyway, together the benchmark's down about 11%, and we've kind of matched that in that time frame. We picked up a little bit in the last. We were talking earlier with Rick in the last week or so. It's been an environment where value we've picked up a little bit because there is some cushion being a value manager in this environment. But we'll see where that goes. So we've picked up a little bit of ground just in this downdraft. Over the last 3 years, it's been a good environment. Last year and 3 years, we've added quite a bit to the value benchmark and a bit ahead of the core benchmark. But it hasn't been a great time in the last year for value stocks. Hopefully we see that turn a little bit. We find a lot of attractive names, and you'll see in a minute when Swami touches on the portfolio, the discount that your portfolio has on a valuation basis relative to the overall market. So we do think that it's attractively positioned and that there's some nice opportunity here, but at the same time, obviously a lot of volatility in the near term, and we can talk a little bit about that.
And you can see actually on page 7, following on that, if you look at the value growth spread in emerging markets and EFI year to date, it's been negative. So value indices have underperformed growth indices. We have generally noticed in the first 6 to 7 months, the growthier parts of the market in U.S., in emerging, in EFI, have become a lot more frothy, meaning much more expensive, a lot more trading volume, a lot more volatility. And, of course, the correction that we have seen in the last week or so is also affecting the growth stocks more in U.S. and other markets. So value stocks are holding up a little better because, as Keith mentioned, there is a margin of safety built into when you're buying companies with strong cash flows, low leverage, and that are cheap. And so they are also generally more mature companies. So we find that that is providing some cushion, certainly in this downturn. And the more expensive parts of the market are getting hammered more. That's generally what we have observed in the last few days.
Ask a question?
Sure.
Interjecting. It looks like, and I'm flashing forward ahead, but in terms of the portfolio's composition, mm-hmm. there's moment at least 10, which don't have to put there, you don't need to, but the median market cap of the portfolio is about half of that of the share market. Is that a staple in terms of portfolio's construction? Will there be an inherent bias towards smaller companies inside the large cap space?
Yes. I mean, the reason there is a you will find this kind of a smaller cap bias pretty much across all our products.
Is it a kind of French circa kind of
no.
factors?
No. We are not choosing a small cap for the sake of small cap.
Smaller company.
Right.
Not just cap.
Right. Smaller companies. So the reason you see the small cap bias is because it's mostly we are going after the deep value names, so the beaten down names. So the if you think of the active risk that we are taking in all our portfolios, we don't take country bets. You know, we're country neutral, right? We don't take any country bets. We don't take huge sector industry bets. The big bet we are taking is that we are going after companies that are very cheap. That used to be, let's say, 3, 4, 5 years ago, higher market cap, but now their size has fallen because they have lost value. And so that's kind of why you see this cap bias.
So in a normal situation, you could see LSV's median market cap position being more similar to the index?
No, you will rarely ever see that.
Okay.
You will rarely ever see that. In fact, the bias, the discount you see can fluctuate, but you're always going to find that our median market cap and weighted average market cap will be lower than the benchmark.
Is this about right in terms of historical discount, or more so?
I don't think it's more so at this point. In early 2000, I mean, this doesn't go back to early 2000, but if you look at our EFI, for example, EFI product, in early 2000, we had a bigger small cap bias in the portfolio.
And we do have constraints or limits on how much we're going to be invested in smaller names. And right now, those constraints are not binding. But we'll, you know, there might be a point where maybe below $3 billion, there might be a lot of attractive names, but we will limit that to maybe 20% of the portfolio, 25% of the portfolio. So there's constraints inherent so that we don't get too small. But as Swami said, we're always going to have a bias towards smaller names, just from a value standpoint, that these cheaper names aren't usually the biggest in the benchmarks.
This is kind of the contrarian factor that's
correct
play here.
It's a contrarian factor. It's the deep value factor. You know, any any time you construct a portfolio that doesn't necessarily go after the biggest companies, right, which is what growth indices are doing, you're going to have a value bias. And what we do is that we make sure that we have the opportunity to buy those fallen angels. The one thing we do is that we do have liquidity requirements. So even if a company is smaller in terms of size or market cap, they still have to trade enough in terms of liquidity for us to be able to buy it.
And then do you follow the same definitions in terms of market cap segmentation as, let's say, the Russell indices, or by the standard? How would you define small, mid, large caps?
I mean, the initial cut on this portfolio, we start with 500 million and above. So we really don't worry about the benchmarks at that point. The benchmarks for us are for sector industry constraints and for the country constraints and bets that we have. So we start with just all companies that are available that are 500 million and above that trade about $1 million of a day.
Okay, that's a fair reminder.
So that's kind of a, gets us into the, mid to large cap names, generally speaking, but there's going to be some smaller names and some, having some exposure there, we think.
Yeah, and then we typically say that not more than 20% of the portfolio can be in the market cap range of, say, 500 million to, maybe about 5 billion. And then at least 40% of the portfolio has to be in market cap above 15 billion. And those constraints are not binding right now.
Understood. Thank you.
And you can see on page 10, again, talking about where we just looked at the market cap, as at the end of June, you can see your portfolio was trading at, about 25% discount to the ACWI ex-US benchmark. And I think probably right now the discount is wider because emerging markets have dropped 20%. EFI has dropped only about 7%. So the portfolio will probably be trading at a deeper discount to the core benchmark. And we have noticed that for the last 3 years, since 2012, emerging markets have been trading at a significant discount to developed markets. In 2013, we saw kind of like starting in May when Bernanke, the then Fed chief, started talking about tapering, we saw a reverse capital flow from emerging markets, which kind of hurt them. Even though U.S. rallied a lot in 2013, emerging markets didn't participate in that, so they were trading at a discount. Even with all the slowdown everybody's worried about in China, in absolute terms, China is still growing fairly fast. 7% is what they're saying, right? Which is still faster than Europe for sure, and it's faster than US. But it's all, Rick and I were talking about, it's all a matter of expectations. If people are expecting 9% and China runs up 60% in the first 6 months in anticipation of that, now you think it's 7%, everyone is disappointed. But in absolute terms, China is still growing faster, and as Keith mentioned, that several emerging markets are kind of in bear territory because they're like corrected about 20%. Some emerging markets have kind of fared a little better, India, South Africa, Morocco, they haven't fallen as much. But overall, when you see this kind of volatility, it tends to affect the emerging markets more because of all the leverage that's flown from developed markets into those markets. And when that money returns, it affects them more. That's one of the reasons why we don't take country bets. Country bets meaning, I think China is going to perform better than South Africa, so I'm going to overweight China versus South Africa. We don't take those bets because we strongly believe those bets are harder to make. Those kind of calls are difficult to make. And what we have seen in the last 5 years is that big macro calls, people haven't gotten them right. Nobody got the interest rates right. Nobody got the oil prices right. Nobody has gotten the, obviously, China situation right. So our view is that be country neutral because our approach is a humble approach. We are saying that we don't know how countries are going to do. We don't have the ability to predict them 2-3 years down the road. But what we are really good at is finding undervalued companies in those countries. So let's focus on our strengths. Focus on those companies that have good cash flows, low leverage, and more mature and are very cheap. And let's buy them, which builds a margin of safety into the portfolio, and not focus on taking country bets. So take a deep value bet, look for cheap companies, and that should provide a cushion in a downturn such as this. So that's kind of our philosophy, and that's what we've always followed. And we basically are happy to admit what we don't know. We don't know how countries are going to do. We don't know how interest rates are going to do. We leave it to others who think they can do it better. So that's our approach.
But you have this country weights paid, so you split up all your investments.
Which is pretty much the same weight as the benchmark. So you can see that Australia is 4.53, the ACWI US benchmark is 4.91. So they're going to be within plus or minus 0.5%. That's all. So what you won't see is that Australia is 4.91 in the benchmark, we are 1%. or we are 8%. You're not going to see that. And that's where people take big country bets.
We're also going to be out of some of the smaller countries you see on the right-hand side of the page. We don't have any exposure to Greece, any to Colombia, you know, some of the smaller countries. We're not going to force buying one name in these countries to have some exposure there. So we're happy to be, we're a little overweight South Africa, but it's not a big deal. A little overweight Brazil, but
China.
Yep, and China.
So we are where we are today. Given what's just recently happened and what I heard China said they were going to do today, it sounded like they were going to embark on some sort of quantitative easing type program. And in light of the fact that possibly some of the other European countries may start to perk up or, you know, do a little bit more extra, where do we go from here in terms of the international markets, in your opinion? I know that that's a difficult question, but I think we're all kind of curious, you know, the state of affairs and going forward from this point forward in Europe.
So if you look at the three regions, like let's look at U.S., you know, EFI, and then emerging markets. U.S. was trading at a bit of a, you know, higher valuation than it historically been. I mean, if you look at the U.S. market, historically U.S. has traded in the last, since 1970s, the median valuation in U.S. markets is about 14 to 15 times forward earnings multiple. S&P 500 at the end of June was trading at about 18. So which is definitely a premium to what it's historically been. So that looks expensive. And this is a lot of people have been saying that. The last time U.S. markets were expensive at about 18 was like 2002, 2003, you know, after the bubble burst, but, you know, just before, you know, when it was still bursting, like 2001, 2002, it was trading at 18. But the difference between 2002 and now is that the interest rates are a lot higher in 2002. So our view is that, and my view is that, we can't look at equity valuation in isolation. We have to compare it to something. And what we usually compare it to is the valuation of bonds. So bond yields are at 2%, 2.1%, 2.2%. Well, bond yields in 2002 was 5, 5.5, 6%. So although equity markets look expensive compared to their own history, compared to bond yields, they don't look that expensive. So what I would see is that we compute this risk premium for forward-looking risk premium per measure for the market, a U.S. market, using a kind of a proprietary approach, and we kind of update that on a once in a month basis, and I'll go update it on Friday. What I will expect to see is that the risk premium on U.S. market has just increased, right? Markets have fallen, so the expected return on stocks have gone up, whereas the yield on bonds have dropped. So the risk premium, if anything, is wide, and what that means is that on a pure valuation basis, equities are going to look actually more attractive now than they were last week. Now, that doesn't mean it can't look even more attractive next week, right? The timing is the difficult part. So the equities can fall more before they recover. But if anything, equities look more attractive in U.S. And I think we're going to find the same thing in EFI. And emerging is going to look even more attractive. But the issue there, of course, is the timing issue, which is when will they recover? We might see this continue for a month or two and have some more correction before it recovers. So valuation models are not timing devices. So our view is that whenever these kind of episodes occur, these corrections are not a bad thing. To get some leverage out of the system is not a bad thing. We've had a six-year bull market. I think it is going to give opportunities for investors like us to go buy some names at attractive prices. And if you have a long enough investment horizon, you should come out ahead. But in the short term, it's going to be choppy, and the volatility is going to be high. So I would view this as opportunities, not to go full-fledged and take all cash and put it into equities, but as opportunities to buy names. Like, let's say there were stocks I wanted to buy last week, and I was really interested in buying them. Well, those stocks, you know, they have good cash flows, low leverage, well-run companies. Well, they became even more attractive today. That's the way we view it.
In environments such as this, do value plays generally tend to outdo growth plays?
Typically, value plays in the last 40 years have been defensive in nature. Except, the only exception we saw to that in the last 40 years was in 2007, 2008. When the market was actually led down by quote-unquote value names, which turned out to be value trap, the financials, right?
Sorry. That was funny, sorry.
I wasn't meant to be funny, but glad it turned out.
Right, it's just
time.
Right, so, but right now that's not the case, because today the expensive parts of the market are not on the value side, it's on the growthier side, it's the Facebooks and the Zingas and LinkedIn and those kinds of social media companies where, you know, everybody's so excited, and the venture capitalists in Silicon Valley are trying to fund even more of the social media companies are extremely impressive valuations. And that's where the action is. And I think that's where the effect is going to be felt the most.
Any other questions from the board or staff?
Is China, are there still transparency issues but in terms of the fundamental bookkeeping?
Yes, there is. I mean, some companies more than others. Companies that are typically listed here, dual listed, they tend to have some better reporting structures. And that's why we are well diversified. I mean, our bet on China is pretty close to the bet in the benchmark. And, you know, we are well diversified. I mean, you can look at the
page 13.
If you look at page 13, you can look at the names. We have about 12 or 13 names there, and small bets in a number of different names. So our view is that if any one company has a firm-specific risk that is due to disclosure issues or reporting issues or irregular accounting, it should not have a huge impact on the portfolio. That's why we don't take big bets. We don't take a 5% bet in one name. Then, if that one name had some you know issues, it's going to affect your portfolio more. So I go back to my earlier statement, which is that our approach to investing, we are a deep value investor, there's a lot of strong research that goes behind what we do, is still a humble approach, saying that I don't have the kind of conviction to say I'm going to put 10% of my portfolio in one name. And to me, high conviction often sounds like overconfidence. It could easily translate to overconfidence, and we are trying to avoid that overconfidence bias, which is one of the most robust biases human beings exhibit, which is they think they're better forecasters than they really are. They think they have better skills than they really do. So we try to avoid overconfidence by diversifying our portfolio across names, by not taking country bets, not taking huge sector bets. So that kind of comes...
Are you more... is your scrutiny a little bit deeper in places like China than it is, say, in England?
You know, one of the things we do with China and a few other emerging countries is we require a dividend. We require that the companies are paying a dividend, and that is, to a certain extent, some protection from a corporate governance standpoint, that the companies... And that's not, we wouldn't do that in England or in the UK, for instance, or Canada. We don't require a dividend. We like dividends. We like companies that pay dividends, but it's not one of our primary factors. But we make sure that companies in China and Russia are paying a dividend and that we're seeing that, and there's a history of paying that. We also like to see 2 or 3 years' worth of you know, reporting and earnings and a number of analysts covering these companies. So it's not just one analyst covering these companies. So we do make an exception for several of the emerging markets, particularly China. We're also not trading in China A shares, not to get too deep into the weeds, but there's separate markets. We trade in the Hong Kong shares. There's a little more, you know, transparency, if you will, in there. You were allowed to trade in the A shares, but we don't. The local shares we're trading in Hong Kong shares.
Yeah, and the dividend payment requirement is really a very good thumb rule. If a company is paying dividends, you know, that means it's generating cash flows. And we also give a lot of weight to cash flows in our model. You know, the company is generating strong EBITDA, cash flow from operations, so cash is king. Earnings can be manipulated, and that's where most of the accounting irregularities occur. So we want to make sure the company is generating cash flows and they're paying dividends, they're buying back stock, and those kinds of things. Well, if you're returning money to your shareholders on a regular basis, it has to come from somewhere.
Yeah, you're making money.
Yeah. So.
Thank you. Rick, while the guys are here, you want to do the value-added report?
Sure. Yes. You can look at that right now. You guys saw this, right?
Yes. Have a copy of it.
I mean, I don't have much to say here. Overall, LFV has added over $4 million in value after payment of fees, and that's over a period of 5 years. They're one of the better managers, I believe, that Stansera has. I caution you when you look at this from this point forward, because the months, the second quarter of each calendar year could potentially look much different, because that's when we adjust the fees based on the performance for the prior year. So just keep that in mind, and you can kind of see that if you look at the quarter from April 14 and then the quarter from April again of 2015, you can see how the fees jump up in that period of time. But other than that, from what I see and looking at other managers, I would put LSV in the top of Sansera's active managers right now. Nate, do you have anything to add to that?
You're here.
Okay.
We appreciate what you're doing for us.
Well, thank you. We appreciate the long relationship, and it's always a pleasure to come out and see you. And if you're in Chicago, make sure to stop by.
I think sometime in the next year you'll see us.
Fantastic. Look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, that'll take us to item 7, our executive director report.
Okay.
Thanks, guys. So item 7A, this is an informational item only, 2015 quarter 2 auxiliary investment report. I'm not going to go over each of the reports within here individually, but I'm just going to give you a summary based on my analysis. So in terms of value added, and just to refresh your memory, and value added, that's the amount of return that a manager gives us over and above the benchmark. And from that number, we subtract out the fees we had to pay to that manager. So it's relative to a passive investment. And again, I remind us all when we come to this item every quarter is that Stan Sara has a choice to invest passively if they want in any asset class, whether it be large cap value, small cap growth. We could actually choose, make a conscious decision to invest passively and earn exactly the benchmark fees for next to nothing. In other words, we wouldn't hardly have to pay any fees. We choose to manage a lot of our portfolio actively and let active managers do it. So what we do is we look at the difference between the manager's return and the passive investment that we could have chosen to invest in and subtract out any fees from that return, and that's the value added. It's a very simple concept, actually. So for 2014-2015, the fund, the active managers added $10.8 million or 65 basis points relative to the passive investment. Interestingly, all of the gains for fiscal year 14-15 can be attributed to quarter two. So we were actually in the red at the end of three quarters of this fiscal year, and we had a really good quarter two that got us to a positive. We were $1 million in the red, and we had about an $11 million quarter two value added, and so it propped up the rest of the three prior quarters of the year.
September through December, is that what you're
right?
Yeah.
July through the end of April would have been. No, I'm sorry. I'm thinking fiscal year. So it is. It's quarter two on a calendar year basis. So okay. July through April would have been the bad 9 months, and then the last quarter really brought us above.
Got it.
Put us in the positive territory. All the managers except PIMCO and Legato added value, although PIMCO and Legato's losses were quite small. And talking about Legato, we will be looking at Legato more formally probably in the next couple months. We're going to wait till the next consultant comes on board, and they've written a lot of theoretical stuff on keeping managers, hiring and firing, and so we're going to get their take on Legato as we go forward. So I've kind of put that off until they come on board. International equities over the last fiscal year added the most value. They added $5.2 million or 150 basis points. So international equities on a relative basis did very well for this portfolio. And then one of the things we've got in this report now is how much money on average managers hold in uninvested assets, and that amount over the course of 2014-15 on average was about $25 million, which represents about 1.9% of the total actual assets that were possibly investable. Investment summary report for 14-15 fiscal year, Stan Sara spent $6.2 million. That's about 33.9 basis points to manage his portfolio. Managerial fees accounted for $5.7 million of that amount. And of the managerial fees, direct lending accounted for $1.1 million of the $5.7 that we spent to manage his portfolio. On an absolute basis, the international asset class cost us the most to manage, but they also added the most value. You remember from what they did earlier, what we talked about earlier. So they cost us $1.3 million in managerial fees to manage our international class, but they added $5.2 million in value. So that's a pretty good proposition as far as I'm concerned. Custodial fees, we spent $376,000 this last fiscal year. That's about half of what we paid the prior fiscal year. We were in the 700,000s, I remember, from the prior fiscal year, so that's also a good turnaround. And then for consultant fees, we spent $170,000. For quarter two, our fees turned out to be $1.9 million. That's 40 basis points on an annualized basis, which is quite a bit. However, that's mostly due to LSV, and we kicked in their performance fee, so we had to pay them more when we trued up their performance over the prior fiscal year. And then Greenfield Real Estate and American Realty Investments popped up in this report for the first time. So their fees are also included in this last quarter for the first time as well. So quarter two seems like a lot in terms of what we've been paying in the past, but again, it's due to those two different things.
Rick, is there any return associated with Greenfield and American Realty?
There is, and we will talk about that when we get to the alternative report. Moving on to the cash flow report, I don't want to spend any time on this. It's really self-explanatory. You can see the actual dollars that StanSara took in versus the actual dollars that went out. And now moving to the alternative report, one of the things that I want to say is that we've got five alternative investments now in this report. This is really good information, and you know, I got to thank Gordon because he kind of put us off on this tangent, but each time I look at this stuff and each time I assimilate this information and try to make sense of it, and I think Natalie as well, it makes more sense to me each time we go through. These are complicated investments. We've learned a lot from them, and these reports help us glean a lot of information. And like I said, it always seems like we're picking up something new each quarter that we put these reports together. But really fast, I want to tell you one thing that we added to this report this time. We are letting you know what's the maximum management fee that can be paid on these investments that we haven't reached the end of the commitment period that we actually pay fees on. So most of these illiquid private equity type investments, you have to pay fees on capital that's uncommitted through the end of the capital commitment period. So we've actually added that to two of our investments, White Oak and Greenfield, because they still have that issue at play here. And so, like, for instance, White Oak, if you look at their, probably should number these pages, if you look at their report here, about three-fourths of the way down the bottom, it shows that the commitment period end date is 12/31/2015. The management fee is 1.5%, and we still have a remaining capital commitment of $3.4 million. So if you just do the math and adjust for the amount of the period left within this year, you can find that the most we'd actually pay on any capital that we actually don't deploy would be $38,000. And then Greenfield, that number came out to be $225,000. That's the most we could pay on a remaining capital that's uncommitted, but the commitment period doesn't end for another year and 4 months, so there's a lot left, and that's why that number may seem a little high. And then if we look at the internal rates of return on each of these investments, White Oak, as of March 31st, shows an IRR of 10.7%. Medley shows an IRR of 5.5%. Raven shows an IRR of 5.4%. Greenfield, 3.3%. And American is 23.5%. That has a lot to do with the fact that the estimated asset value, we've been in this investment for a very short period of time, but the estimated asset value at the end of the first quarter of this year is greater than the actual cash flows that we've put into this investment. So in other words, we've only been invested in this for about 6 months. We've put $7.7 million into this investment, and the investment's worth almost $8 million right now. So that tends to lead to a very high internal rate of return.
How did that happen?
So which also leads me to believe, and I've known this for a while, is that the estimated asset value that's placed on these investments comes from the managers themselves, which the estimated asset value in the calculation of the internal rate of return has a lot of weight in what that internal rate of return is. So if one were to try to get a different internal rate of return, they would probably want to spend a lot of time on enhancing the value of that asset. That'd be the easiest way to enhance the internal rate of return is make that asset value very large. So, to answer your question, we take these from the quarterly reports that we get from the managers. Having said that, I think what I'm going to start to do going forward is I'm going to discount that asset value by something to account for the fact that it's an uncertain number. It's a variable number,
and there's no liquidity in that number. In other words, we couldn't cash that. We couldn't get that money out today if we wanted to. And so when you see these internal rates of return on these sheets, the cash flows are all exactly correct. They're the money that we've spent and the money we've taken in. But that asset value assumes, the internal rate of return assumes that you could cash out that asset exactly at that price at this date, which is not a very realistic assumption. So I'm thinking the next time I present internal rate of return information, I'm probably going to discount a little bit that asset value for the uncertainty and the fact that it's very illiquid. And I see you have a scowl.
No, that's not a scowl. That's no, your question.
A furrowed brow?
No, I don't have enough hair on my brow. It's, once a year, that asset value is audited by a third-party accounting firm.
At the end of the year.
Correct?
Yes.
I mean, does it make sense to calibrate this report with that number uniquely whenever that third-party kind of audited number comes through?
I think that the first quarter of the calendar year report will be a little more valid.
Okay.
I'd have much more faith in it. However, I still think the illiquidity factor comes into play here in determining the internal rate of return. Because again, you can only realize that internal rate of return if you were actually able to liquidate.
Agreed.
Right now, today.
Agreed.
If you were able to liquidate that investment at that price.
Sure.
Which you can't do.
Right.
So, but anyway, it's a good approximation and it's a good relative comparison between alternative investments. You can compare one to the other. And it's a fair basis.
Rick, if you do discount it, I think you need to make sure and publish what you chose to discount. Because you could put something underwater.
Yes.
When it wasn't underwater. And what they did is the more conservative way to do it, I think. Rather than saying, if you went the other way, then it would almost be fraudulent that you would be overstating what your value was. They understated what the value was. And so it made it less risky, let's say.
Right.
So if you're going to decide to discount, make sure that we'll it's in big letters. Yeah.
I think the point is, I just want to make everybody aware that these internal rates of return are only good as the assumptions that go into calculation.
Sure.
And if you can't get that exact number out of it, whether it's, even if this number is exactly correct, you still can't liquidate your investment today at that price and get that return right now. That's kind of the biggest thing for me. But
sure. We
will definitely note that in this report if we so choose to do.
Call it an illiquid asset discount then.
Yeah. It, all five of them are in the same kind of boat of not having the checks of the market or something else, right?
Yeah, well, there's a term on them. We can't get the money out, so we're stuck with it.
No, but I mean, when we talk about asset value, it's something the manager gave us as an asset value.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's not something you can pick up a Wall Street Journal and read what the stock sold for.
No.
Or couldn't borrow against it.
And some of these firms, at least a few of them, have third-party people placing values on these, but I think a couple of them don't.
Well, they should all have... Legally, for LP investments, they should have.
Oh, I know what it is. One of them, at least, has the ability to override whatever the third party says.
We should have a special due diligence meeting. But no, that makes sense. I mean, for them to be able to. Is that on the annual audit? Let's get into the weeds later.
I don't know. Yeah.
What am I talking about? It's my last meeting. You do whatever you want.
No. You can throw questions our way. We will take
it
up with
anyway.
But I like Jeff's idea of making a note of the liquidity question, because the liquidity is legitimate.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's it. There's no
any questions for Rick? It's a good report.
Thank you.
Okay, Nate, you got your spurs on?
Spurs are on.
Okay, let's hear our concluding SIS report.
Well, before I jump in, I'd just like to also share my sentiments. It has been an absolute pleasure to work and serve this board for the last 5 years. My hope is that there are some friendships that will supersede our contractual time together. I hold very dear. Secondly, I'd really like to highlight and compliment staff, Kathy, Kelly, Natalie, team led by Rick. This is an exceptional staff. I have the purview of working with a lot of different teams, and I kind of shared over lunch, it's a little bit double-edged sword in terms of a compliment to the staff, but what they are able to do in terms of their decisiveness, in terms of their diligence, is truly, truly remarkable. And I'm sure like every department in the plan, in the system, maybe at times feel under-resourced, but from what I see in my vantage point, what they accomplish is exceptional. You know, I've seen plans not want to move forward on a custodian RFP because for the 30-plus, 50-plus people that work in that process, it would just be too much to train them. And then to back that up with a consultant RFP, well, they would never embark on that so readily. I just want to compliment and really affirm what they are capable of and just hope they never retire because it's truly a special group. And then lastly, you know, which I'll have the pleasure of highlighting this in the performance, I am very pleased to look at what we've accomplished together with our time. It's not easy. We sit around this table monthly, sometimes more than that, and we try to decide how we think the world is spinning, and that is a hard, arduous task. But collectively, if I was to say one comment on the corporate character of this board, it's that the people around this table care, and it's a real privilege and honor to work alongside that. So thank you. All right. With that, we will delve into final quarterly update. Page one. We can look at the U.S. In particular, corporate earnings have beginning to stall. And as Swami highlighted, what the markets really care about is the growth of the growth rate, not so much the absolute growth, which, for instance, in China is very impressive, 6-7% as a country growing year over year that big. That's impressive. But what the markets want to see is how does the growth rate or the change from the previous year and the year previous to that, how does the growth rate, is that on an uptick or a downtick? And the growth rate, the growth of the growth rate in China is stepping down. So markets don't necessarily like to see that. The Russell 3000, rather flat. That's the broad U.S. equity market around 0.3% for the quarter. We see the international space down just under 1%, 0.8%. The Grexit, the Greek bailout, looks like it has some traction in the second quarter. It was up in the air. But we did see some positive returns in growth from other portions of the Eurozone in terms of the UK. China, this is really interesting. Obviously, we wake up in the morning and we see China down 7% in the market for the last 4 or 5 days. I wrote this out to try to put into context. China is a big deal. Here's why it's a big deal. They are the second largest economy in the world, probably someday the largest. To see them struggle in terms of managing their markets is alarming. Contagion, while it has never really been a case with China, meaning if they sneeze, the rest of the world catches a cold, that's not what has always been the case. That's been the U.S. But now people are wondering, China has their hands all over the globe. How will this affect? What contagion fears exist? And the answer is, we don't know. We don't know. But what we do know are looking at returns. And when I wrote down three trailing period returns for the Chinese stock market, over the last 3 months, the Chinese stock market is almost down 40%. That's staggering. In the last 6 months, the market's down 8.2%. If I look at the trailing 1 year period, meaning where the market is from 1 year ago today, it's up 32%. That's staggering. So what that tells you is the market shot up. It was up over 100% in a year in terms of where the base was, and it's correcting. To some extent, that should be a small sigh of relief for institutional investors or those that are in the markets permanently. This was necessary. For the first time, individual Chinese had the opportunity to purchase companies domiciled in China. And for those individuals that have been hoarding cash in their mattress for years, this seemed like an opportunity, especially when you see your neighbor getting rich. The Joneses exist all over the world. And that was happening. And they were able to invest on margin, which means they were able to lever up the dollar they put in place, or the yuan, whatever. They were able to lever that up. And when fear and human behavior come into play, you see correction. So we're going to see how that plays out. It kind of feels like maybe 98, when the Russian ruble crisis took place. it was an issue, it was a deal, it affected global markets, but it didn't derail them. Usually when the U.S. derails, that the whole world gets derailed. But I wanted to comment on that because when you look to see where the market in China has come from 3 months ago to where it comes from 1 year ago, if I told you China's going to be up 32% a year ago, and we're sitting here in last September, wow, seems like a great opportunity. Who would have ever thought it would have gone up 80, 90% and now back down 40%. So I thought that was an interesting stat, and those statistics are as of today. I did that this morning before I got in the car. When we look at the globe, no surprise, when we see confidence kind of scattered around the globe, North America, it's the most confident confident continent in terms of institutional investors, and no surprise, Asia and certain European countries are the least confident. But the overall confidence index is above its neutral level of 100. We saw for the quarter the REIT index, which is real estate equity, down around 10% for the quarter. The REITs have been a strong, strong area over the last few years. We'll see that in the monthly performance report. But private real estate, which is not priced daily, more stable with a 3.6% return. And lastly, we saw rising rates. The 10-year yield rose around 43 basis points in the second quarter. That definitely negatively impacted the bond sector. So a lot to highlight. Usually I only comment on a couple different things on this page, but there's about five or six that are really noteworthy. Even when you see the market up 0.3%, you think, it's a boring quarter. Quite the contrary. A lot has happened. Page two, we'll get into our portfolio. And what I'm going to do is I'll talk about the next two pages, which highlights our managers more in detail. And when we get to the performance with the numbers, I'm pretty much just going to comment on total fund return because it's redundant to go through the managers again. So our portfolio, not unlike the broader equity market, up 0.5% for the quarter. Pretty good when you see that the U.S. in particular, the Russell 3 was up 0.3%. So for us to be able to beat a straight equity benchmark is pretty good. That ranked pretty well, 19th percentile among all public funds. The median manager was flat, 0%, and 80 basis points above our policy index. So it's a number of things that are contributing to that, not least to mention our illiquid investments that have helped in terms of trailing performance. It doesn't get much better than this, folks. When I look at our 13 managers, 12 of them provided positive or net neutral performance. Only one manager this quarter was negative. That was Capital Prospects, but we all know they've been a shining star over the longer 3-5 year period. The top two managers are passive indices, track the index, S&P 500, Russell 1000 Growth. They track their index. Jackson Square provided 170 basis points of outperformance. Very, very strong. They continue to be a phenomenal team and partner. BlackRock, 10 basis points. Dodge and Cox, I'm going to pause here because I want to highlight something from our last meeting. For the quarter, they beat their index by 260 basis points. Very strong. If you remember, Wendell was here. We asked him about what was the historical experience like for Stan Serra way back when they first got into the fund in terms of a dollar amount. Wendell didn't have that information on the top of his head, and I don't count that against him. It's a pretty hard stat. But he came back to me the very next day, and he gave me these numbers, and I'll share them with you. A $10 million that was invested in 1972 by this plan, should it had not been touched, meaning we didn't take any withdrawals out, we left dividends, but still net management fees, today would have been worth $1.15 billion. That compares to the same investment in the S&P 500, which would have been around $630 million. So almost a double in terms of the partnership between what we would have got if we just left the passive versus being with Dodge and Cox. Now, we did withdraw funds. We withdrew $455 million over that period of time from that manager. And that manager today is still worth $188 million, that portfolio. Pretty remarkable. And what this highlights is what incremental value does to a fund over decades. So when we see a manager that can provide 100 basis points of relative outperformance over long-term trailing periods, you get this kind of compounded magic that occurs. And it's great to be able to still have a manager in our portfolio that long. Not a lot of funds can tout that they've kept an equity manager over four decades. Great. That's a highlight. Wanted to share it. Mark it on your hearts. But we also suffered with them in 08 and 09. I remember having very similar conversations where it was tough times. But this is, again, the board stuck to it, and they've been paid well for it. Number six, we see Legato having a strong relative quarter. beating its benchmark by 80 basis points. Pyramid also beating its benchmark by 80 basis points. LSV beating its benchmark by 70 basis points. Dodge and Cox Bond down 1.1%, but beat the Barclays Ag by 60 basis points, so relatively preserving value. That's important. And PIMCO likewise kind of edging out its index around 40 basis points. Now, our real estate composite, this is noteworthy. The REIT benchmark that we have, which Rick and I have discussed quite a bit, down 10%. Very, very strong down quarter for the REIT equity index. Our portfolio only down negative 3.5%, and this is because we have rotated into more private investments. Those simply are not priced as regularly, we also see, though, that being void of that market movement, those market gyrations, does preserve relative value over longer periods of time. Now, that is really a market liquidity issue. You know, these private holdings, are affected when the markets go down, but price discovery is a lot more difficult, and it takes time to get a real estate appraised, get comps, all that. What happens is it happens once a quarter, and only a portion of the portfolio gets appraised. That's the benchmark. I'm referencing the longer-term private real estate benchmark. So over the course of a year, all the properties are getting appraised, but it never happens at one time. So they carry forward baseline asset values, which over a longer period of time, it works out, but you get dislocations in terms of equity evaluations over shorter period quarter times. Our direct lending portfolio, it's nice to see. I'm glad I was able to be here 2 years into it to be able to say it's doing what we thought it would. Provided a quarterly return of 2.9%. The language there is wrong. It is above its stagnant net target return of 2.2% or 9% per annum. We'll see that play out when we get to the other performance section. Our one loan manager that was net negative on a relative basis was Capital Prospect. They were down 10 basis points. They're down 1.3% versus 1.2% for their index. Longer periods, their three-year trailing return, 19.6%. That is 410 basis points above its policy index. Okay, with that, let's turn to page 6, please. We'll skip some of these asset allocations.
No, you're being tricky. There's no page numbers.
Are you sure? I'm looking at page numbers on the PDF. Okay, let's just turn to the section right here that has.
No.
Get to the numbers.
Performance
summaries.
I thought that's what we were reading.
It's all the same.
Yeah.
One's with words, one's with.
We already did this, mate.
It's okay. It's okay. That's good. That means I'm doing it right. The only thing I want to highlight here, well, there's a couple things. You're going to sit through it all. The most important thing I want to highlight is total fund. That's what matters. It's, you know, I hope everybody shares in the short-term pride. It's okay to every once in a while pat oneself collectively in terms of what we've been able to accomplish. But when we look over the quarter, calendar year, fiscal year, 2 year, 3 and 5 years, and then I have another slide that goes out to 10 years, but the fund is performing quite well. That five-year return, well, a quarter, we don't like to see 0.5% for a quarter. We do like that it outperformed its policy index by 80 basis points. But let's look at the longer periods, that three-year, five-year. Three-year to outperform by 170 basis points of policy index, that matters. If I compound that out, I mean, I don't know if I can do it off the top of my head, but, you know, you're looking at something over 5% cumulative outperformance against your policy index. But if I do the math, more or less. I'm doing exponentials in my head right now, but that's meaningful. And you do that over 5 years, it's even more powerful. It's the compound effect of interest. And we don't like, you can't eat peer rankings, but they feel good. And you can see where we're lining up. 5 years in that 14th percentile, which the lower, unlike your height when you're in grade school and investments, the lower the percentile, the better. So to be in 14th percentile, that matters. The other thing that I highlight in the same horizontal category is to look at our policy index versus that of the median defined benefit plan. And this just kind of lets you know, where are we at? What's our bogey? How's our bogey faring to the masses? And it's positive. I like to see that our policy index in and of itself is outperforming the median manager. And that, to a certain extent, gives credit to our asset allocation work. When we do the long day, which you guys are going to gear up to do, it's nice to be able to see that the decisions that we've made are paying off. That's it on that page. Everything else I've talked about, legato. You get to have other people tell you what to do there. I don't have to worry about it. Let's look at international equity on the very next page. I thought this was really interesting because if you guys, can you see the LSV and the pyramus lines on page 7, 2 of this portion of it. If you look at the peer ranking, so let's just look at the quarter. Do you see where it says 55, 55, and the composite at 41? Is everybody?
Yeah.
Okay, can you see that? What's interesting is if you take that all the way out longer periods, the individual manager's universe performance is much lower than the composite. The composite, the combination of the two managers together and the dollars invested with them, is much more accretive, and that is encouraging to me because the partnership, you have one that's more growthy, and you have one that's more value. And you can see out there in the 5-year, you know, while both managers providing relative outperformance, from a peer ranking, not entirely impressive, 82% peer ranking, 79%, but the combination of the two of them, a much more impressive number. And that goes to an intentional pairing of a growth manager and a value manager. Fair to highlight. The next page, this gets into, you can see the fixed income managers, likewise adding relative value. The real estate, we can see here in particularly how the addition of the private investment managers, when the market goes down, that really helps. And as they continue to ramp up their investments, we'll see a more normalization in terms of relative outperformance. But nonetheless, it's been positive that we've moved those dollars from liquid real estate into private. That movement has been positive. And lastly, our direct lenders. We can see with that fiscal year, trailing 1-year performance, 9%. And that compares to our policy index of 9%. And that compares to a Barclays aggregate 1-year return of 1.9%, very, very favorably. And so we rotated funds out of equities and fixed incomes to fund this allocation. Equities returning for the year around 7%, 7.4, depending upon where you look. And you can see fixed income around 1.9. It was the right decision, and the fund is getting paid for it, and I believe it will continue to do so. Page 10, it's basically a visual of similar graphics that we've already looked at with the exception of a 7 and 10-year trailing period. And if you look at the bottom there, you can see the story continues. Strong absolute performance and also even stronger relative performance outperforming our policy index over both time periods, which is good. The next page, page 11, this is attribution. This shows where we're getting relative outperformance from the different asset classes. And when you have all of those colors to the right, that is good. That means everybody's sharing the load and is helping participate. Selection effect is the most robust portion. Allocation effect is just talking about how our dollars are relative to our policy index. And the interaction effect, there's three forms of attribution: selection, attribution, interaction. The interaction column is more just a catch-all, a transaction, kind of a rounding column. But all in all, 84 basis points of relative outperformance, very positive. There's three more pages I'll highlight, and I won't spend much more than a few seconds on because our friends at LSV already commented on it, most of it, and that's the markets. On page 12, this looks at the U.S. equity markets right here. You can see kind of two interesting things. One I just commented on, and the fourth bullet point in the top left quadrant, that's for the year, the Russell 3000 index returned 7.3%. It doesn't happen often, but that's exactly where I think our capital market expectations were. Those estimates are over longer-term periods, but it's interesting to see over a short sample size that kind of 7% more or so is where the market returned. The other thing I'll highlight are just the two sector differences. You see over the year, energy decimated down roughly 24 a quarter of its total net value for the trailing 1-year period. And likewise, the mirror image is healthcare. Had a very, very robust year, up around 27% for the quarter. I don't have any insights on that, just interesting to see how it pays to be a diversified investor. So the next page would be flipped far all the way. There are no page numbers on your report, but there are on mine, which is even more bizarre. Page 39, this would be the first page in the bond section. When I hear the pages stop flipping, I'll know you're close to being there. I'm just going to look at Gordon and see when he gets there.
Never again.
Follow. Yep.
Three from the back.
Well, that's easier.
How many?
Four.
I'm going to have a whole minute to sing the national anthem.
Go.
So, on page 39, the bond market, just visually, don't even worry about the numbers, but you just look at the way the colors are laid out, and I thought it's pretty interesting. The top left, the quality performance. Now, these are just quarter. You have the yellow, that's a quarter return, and the purple is the year return. But every portion of the quality spectrum in terms of the credit market, a mirror image almost in terms of what happened in the most recent quarter and how it's performed over the year. For the year, they all have produced positive returns. But man, for this most recent quarter, as we saw volatility in the market come back in place, we saw every sector of that quality spectrum get hit. And in particular, the lower credit portion of the spectrum down, the corporate credit spectrum down the most, the BAA section down over 3% for the quarter. And that kind of plays out in the bottom left. You can see sector performance. Corporate credit hurt the most, and above that, the duration. The longer duration, the things that are not going to come due for over 7 years or over 10 years, they're the most sensitive to interest rate movements. They were hurt the most over the most recent quarter. So not a safe haven. And the last page is the currency section. It would be in maybe three or four more pages beyond where you're at. We see a continuation of the story in terms of a race to the bottom, currencies devaluing themselves. The euro, the pound, the yen, all down over the year. Now, that said, over the most recent quarter, we saw a snapback in both the euro and the pound of strength versus vis-a-vis the dollar. But over a longer period, sort of the most trailing 1 year, currencies have been devaluing themselves. And then lastly, the yield curve, which is the bottom down here, it's a boring chart, but very, very powerful. The world, especially the credit market, operates off of this. The yellow line, that's the most recent line. The blue line is where we were a year ago, and the orange line is where we were a quarter ago. And if you look at the far end out here, you can see that the yield curve moved up at the far end. That's actually pretty interesting. You see, it was flattening. Flattening is a common occurrence when you get to an economy that's starting to normalize, and that's before the front end of the curve actually might become inverted and go a bit higher. But to see the far end of the curve actually rise, that's a bit interesting, and it shows that we're nowhere near out of the woods, which I don't think anybody thought we were. But it'll be interesting to see that. The shorter end of the curve is, you can see the yellow actually above both of them. That's responding to the fact that the markets believe the Fed will raise interest rates soon. Central governments can control the short end of the curve pretty well. They cannot control the far end of the curve. That's the free markets. We'll see how that happens. Okay, there you go. Any questions?
You make us wish you were going to be here next month.
Man, I feel... Look, the guy's going to do great. I know you're in great hands, but the poor guys walk in, to some extent, like, the fund is just done. So nobody can take credit in terms of just how well the fund is done. I mean, if you want to give me credit, I guess I'll take it, but you know, a lot of it's just the markets. And so, but I'm confident, you know, I shared this with Rick and Kathy, that we've laid out a pretty well-defined, articulated plan. That's to some extent in place. Now, that can always change, but the blueprint that has been put in place has been working, and I hope and I will continue to follow the plan, and I will continue to watch and see its success and be very, very happy for everybody here in the county as I watch you from afar. So
it's been a great partnership.
Thank you
very much for the enthusiasm and the personal touch that you've injected into the relationship. So
I appreciate it.
We can't do anything but wish you the very best for wherever you're going.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Okay. Thank you again.
You're welcome.
I understand that we need to go to closed session.
Yes, you do.
So do we allow the room to clear before we ask for that motion? Okay.
Do you want me to hang around, or are we good to go?
I think we're good.
Okay. It's like the last episode of Cheers.
Thanks.
Take care.
Thank you.
Meet you at the bar.
Okay. That's good.
Cheers.
before dinner.
Okay, we'll entertain a motion to move to closed session. Motion, is there a second? I think Gordon seconded it. Or is he going to?
I'll second.
Okay, a motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Okay, we are in closed session. And we would like to report on our closed session.
I have a report out on 9A. We have a motion by Trustee Lynch and seconded by Trustee DeMartini to reject the settlement offer presented by Buck. We have another motion to direct, we have another motion presented by Trustee Lynch and seconded by DeMartini to direct Stan Serra, General Legal Counsel, to continue mediation.
Okay, thank you. We'll proceed that way. Brings us then to members' forum, and we'll just start here and move around the room. Anybody have, something to offer? Ladies?
I have nothing.
Supervisor? Treasurer? Sam?
Nothing.
Mike?
Nope.
Kathy?
No, thank you.
Rick? Okay. In that case, we stand adjourned. Thank you.